You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Dave Hodges is as mad as hell, and he's not going to take it anymore. I'd like to help you, don't you? Wish I really, really would, but the feeling in my head, it's emotion, it's not good. I'm standing in a window tunnel, shouting through the roar, and I'd like to give you information. Ask me for the blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, blood makes noise. And I can't really hear you in the thick of my ear. Common sense is not so common. This is the Common Sense Show with Dave Hodges.
Hi, everybody. This is Dave Hodges. I'm the host of the Common Sense Show, and we are the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. Welcome back. Glad you could join us. Thanks for holding over through the break. This hour, we are brought to you by Steve Quayle, Renaissance Precious Metals, converting your soon-to-be worthless cash into precious metals. Give Steve a call to find out how he does it. There's absolutely no pressure whatsoever. 406-586-4842. We're also brought to you by my good friend Bob Griswold and ReadyMadeResources.com. I call him King Prepper for a reason. Anything that you need in prepping, well, whatever it is. I mean, you want communications equipment, you want water filtration, you want night vision, whatever you want, Bob has it, and he finances the high end, and he gives free consultations, which is almost unheard of in this business. How do you get a hold of him? Well, you go to readymaderesources.com, look at what they have, and then give them a call. And then finally, we're brought to you by preparewithdave.com. You want storable food? We've got the best deal on the planet. Absolutely number one, no question. A lot of people said, Dave, we can't afford to buy the 6 months or 2 years supply of food that's recommended, but we could do 30 days. So we went back to our manufacturer and said, what can you do? And we came up with a 4-week supply that'll get you through a lot of initial crises. And we dropped the price for that from $250 to $99 to try to remove all the obstacles that you have to not protect your family. Because FEMA has already said, when crisis strikes, you can't count on us. And boy, they've proven that from Katrina forward. So how do you do it? How do you get started in this? How do you protect your family? Go to preparewithdave.com. Write that into the URL. No coupon code needed. This is the best deal on the planet with storable food. Well, our guest this hour, and I'm really looking forward to this interview. As many of you know, followed me for years, I'm a former college basketball coach. I've been a head coach for football, basketball, and baseball at the high school level. And I love sports, but I hate corruption in sports. My freshman coach in college once said, you know, sports are great because it's the one of the few endeavors in life that you're ever going to get to be judged solely by your talents, no politics. Well, that's not the case anymore. And here to talk to us about that is Brian Toohey. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. It's been too long since we've had you on.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, Dave. I appreciate it.
Well, Brian, you wrote a book called The Fix Is In, and we talked about that about 3 years ago, right after I started on the satellite provider we're at now with Global Star Radio Network. And you went in and talked about a lot of the corruption in sports and how sporting events frequently will defy statistical probabilities and outcomes. And that has really been an evidence for me in the NBA playoffs. I happened to watch Game 6 of the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Golden State Warriors, and I had recorded on DVR so I could fast forward through the fluff, and I was stunned at what I saw. And so I'm no stranger to breaking down film, and I looked at 17 times that Oklahoma City went to the basket in the second half because they were killing Golden State from the three-point line. And so Golden State got physical, said, okay, we dare you to go to the basket, and they beat the crap out of them at the rim. And so I did stats on that. 17 trips to the rim in the second half where I thought there was significant contact that should have been called, even in NBA playoff style, and only 4 were called. And 2 of the 4 were called at meaningless, the game is overtime. So I look at that and I'm saying, man, that's bad. And then we saw the same pattern in Game 1 between Golden State and Cleveland, And I thought Cleveland got a royal screw job from the referees. I thought they were wearing Golden State Warrior uniforms. What's your take on all this, and what's going on with the NBA playoffs?
Well, I think it's very interesting that most fans, I think, understand but don't always comprehend the fact that the officials can't control the momentum and what happens in the game. And they can do it by calling fouls, or, as you point out, by not calling fouls. And that's something, you know, there's a lot of eggheads out there who do a lot of statistical analysis and break down games through these statistics and say, oh, well, you know, this team got so many free throws, this, you know, got so many fouls. But what you can't quantify is the non-calls and when the non-calls are made or when they should be made and those sorts of things. And, you know, the very real fact is in the NBA, in any major professional sport, these are entertainment businesses. These are not, you know, sports as you think of. They're actually big industry of professional sports, which is an entertainment industry. And they can actually manipulate the outcome of their own game if they want to and do so legally. So if the employer, like the NBA, tells its employees, the officials, hey, we want you to officiate this way. We want you to give this team or this player some leniency. We want you to be more strict on these sorts of calls. They can manipulate the game just through that and get the desired outcome they may want, and it's perfectly legal for them to do so.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And the non-calls are the hardest ones to see the corruption in this. But the NBA, but see, here's where the NBA hurts themselves. This is their Achilles heel. They actually keep statistics on referee calls, and they will tell you out of their league office that referees are typically wrong 15% of the time. And so I had that in mind when I did that analysis in Game 6 of Oklahoma City and Golden State, and they were wrong 400% of the time. So,
well, that's exactly it. I mean, at 15% of the time, where did they pull that number out of? I mean, who came up with that? I mean, you know, they're the only ones who are basically going to sit down and watch every single game and monitor every single call, if they really do that, to come up with such a number. I mean, regular people, no one's going to sit there and figure these sorts of things out, because you can't. I mean, you can go through a box score, and you can, you know, multiple box scores, and you can find all sorts of statistics, but things like non-calls are impossible to really ferret out. And that's the other problem that bothers me, and which a lot of fans should think about, is when you watch a game, be it a basketball game, a hockey game, a football game, and you hear the announcers even say, hey, they're really letting them play out there. What does that mean? Well, it's meaning basically the officials aren't calling the fouls or the penalties they should be calling, and therefore the game's really not being played under these league's specified rules. And why? Why is that happening, and what's the outcome because of that?
Yeah, a bad ref is just incompetent and misses calls, but a biased ref, a terrible ref, is one that has an agenda. And I have to tell you, being a former college basketball coach, I didn't see very many biased refs. We'd see a couple that didn't like us. We knew it, and we got the treatment. But it wasn't common. In the NBA, when you get to the playoffs, I see it all the time. I mean, you can smell that kind of crap as a coach miles away. And the NBA has always been a corrupt league. And I'll tell you, though, where they really don't get enough criticism, although they get some. There's actually a guy here in Phoenix. He's on the number one sports talk show. It's called the Doug and Wolf Show. And Doug, here in Phoenix, what he says is that the NBA lottery is fixed. I couldn't agree with him more. And that's they draw straws basically to determine, you know, who gets the order, the pecking order, for the selection of the best college talent coming out, for the layman listening to us. Do you see any phony baloney stuff going on with regard to the draft lottery in the NBA?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think you go all the way back to the very first lottery selection, which was when Patrick Ewing was on the line, and they did it with the old envelope system. And, you know, if you can go back, and I think it's still on YouTube, you can actually watch it. That, I'm certain, was rigged to make sure Patrick Ewing, that number one draft pick, the big number one draft pick of that year, the can't-miss prospect who became a Hall of Famer, they made sure he wound up on the New York Knicks, as opposed to being in Sacramento or Seattle, some other far-flung place where he wouldn't have made an impact. They put him in New York because they wanted that talent on the Knicks in the number one media market, and they wanted him to make a splash in the league. And I think since then, since that success, yeah, they've done these sorts of things every now and again when they want certain players to go to certain teams. And I think what's even worse, what a lot of people talk about, but for whatever reason it doesn't sink in, is the game tanking that takes place in the NBA to get supposedly better chances in that draft lottery by being worse teams. Because as soon as certain NBA teams are out of the running, they literally start throwing games and losing on purpose to make sure to get more ping pong balls in the hopper to supposedly get that better draft pick.
Yeah, here locally, now I don't pay much attention to the Phoenix Suns anymore. It's kind of funny. My wife and I, especially she was in high-level corporate America, we used to have fourth-row seats. And the Suns were owned by Jerry Colangelo, who was a really good owner. But then they were taken over by Robert Sarver, the worst owner in professional sports. And so we lost interest. But what I have seen up close and personal, because you can't help but notice it and see it, even if you don't follow the team, the Suns have tanked 2 years in a row. They've withheld their best player down the stretch of each season from playing. In each case, it was a different player. And so they could secure the worst record in the league. And as a consequence, they finally got the number one choice this year. But, you know, you're right. Why would anyone pay their money to go see a team that would do such a thing?
Well, and the psychotic part is the commissioner of the league now, Adam Silver, says tanking doesn't exist. He said numerous times this doesn't go on in our league, yet Mark Cuban, who owns the Dallas Mavericks, went on the Dan Patrick Show 2 years ago and said, yeah, we tanked. And then he went on this year on Dr. J's podcast and said, yeah, I took my team out to dinner and told them losing is our best option right now. So he admitted they tanked again for a season, yet when the commissioner fined him, I think it was $600,000 for making those comments on Dr. J's podcast, he still refused to admit that teams are tanking.
Wait, it's just amazing. He enforces the no tanking rule with a huge fine and then turns around and says it doesn't exist. Didn't J. Edgar Hoover once deny the existence of the mafia for about 40 years? Yeah. That's what
it's
this reminds
thing.
Me of.
I mean, it's bizarre because I've found numerous quotes, and it's in my old book, The Fix Is In, and it's going to be in this new book that I've been working on, where, I mean, I take the league to task over this tanking thing because that is outright game fixing. I mean, it's basically ownership going through to the general manager, going through to coach, passing on this message to the players that we don't need to win, we don't really care, we want to lose because we want to get a better draft pick. And my argument is if you can do this in professional sports, if you can do this in the NBA at supposedly meaningless games, who's to say you can't do the same thing and send the same message to players in what are supposedly meaningful games? Because once you start doing it, you know, where do you stop?
Well, that's precisely what busted NBA official who served time for fixing games, Tim Donaghy, said in his book. Let's talk about his book a little bit. What struck you about the claims that he made when he wrote his book from prison?
Well, I think the big thing was is he basically confirmed what I had talked about and written about, was the fact that the league told the officials how to officiate games. And the officials basically got the message from the NBA before every game of what to look for, what to not bother calling. And in doing so, they kind of knew what the league wanted and needed in terms of who to win, who to lose, to maybe push this playoff series to a fifth game or a sixth game when it should have been a four-game sweep. And he basically confirmed all this in his book. And the amazing thing is the sports media, of course, totally shot down all of his claims. Because they said, well, he's a convicted criminal now. We can't believe anything he says. But yet, before he got convicted, he was basically one of the best NBA refs in the league and still would have been in the league had the FBI not arrested him.
Well, when he got busted, if memory serves me correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't he strike a deal with prosecutors and get less time? And if his claims weren't valid, then he would have got more time for lying to the feds.
Well, that's part of the deal. Yeah, exactly. He did. He actually never got convicted of fixing any games whatsoever because the FBI didn't want to try to prove that, and the NBA certainly didn't want to go after him for that because that's the last thing they needed was even more scandal when he said, yeah, I did fix game A, B, or C. So he basically went to jail just on, like, you know, gambling charges, interstate gambling, and, like, wire fraud and that sort of thing. But, yeah, he did cut a deal and basically spilled the beans about how the NBA works, and the FBI thanked him for it, but didn't really use that to go after the league. Because, again, if the league was doing exactly what Donahue said, the league wasn't committing any crime whatsoever.
Yeah, you know what that reminded me of? And now it's coming back to me very clearly. But, you know, when we had Hillary Clinton running for president, and it was clear, even clearer from the person who let her off the hook, James Comey, then the head of the FBI, said that, yeah, she broke the law, essentially, but she didn't get prosecuted because she was reckless versus criminal. And to me, the FBI didn't want to know the truth for political reasons and didn't act on it. And now we look at this situation. Do you think that was the case here, where a higher power was telling the FBI, don't go there?
Oh, I'm certain. I think the NBA stepped in and said, we don't want you looking into that. I mean, it's amazing. I did a lot of research on FBI files and game fixing in every sport imaginable. In fact, through the Freedom of Information Act, I obtained every file the FBI had dating back to the 1960s on game fixing in the United States. There's over 400 files, and in a couple of the files, they literally wrote, the FBI wrote, that like with the NFL, the NFL would tell them, hey, don't look into this, we'll take care of it, it's our problem. And the FBI capitulated and said, okay, you guys investigate yourself and let the matter drop.
Yeah, there is some collusion there, because these pro sports leagues have had enjoyed terrific tax advantages that myself as a small business owner, I don't get to do. You know, they get to be tax-exempt foundations in the NFL. Would they make $9 billion last year? To me, as your book said a few years ago, the fix is indeed in, no question about it. But, you know, too, here's another thing, and I wonder if you've ever looked at this angle of it. The NBA and the NFL are known for promoting these socialist liberal causes. You know, they're anti-Second Amendment, they're pro this or anti that, and they're always putting their political stances out there. Do you think this is because they're doing favors for certain groups, it seems like, socially, rather than just promoting their own sport? Is there some collusion there outside the NBA or NFL that you've ever found?
Not that I've ever necessarily found, but I've never necessarily looked for it either. But like you said, the interesting thing for me is the fact that, you know, professional sports today, I believe, act a lot like they did back in Roman times with the gladiator games. That these are put on, you know, back in Roman times, they were put on by the state. They were meant to distract the populace, and they did a very good job back then of distracting the populace while the government ran rampant. And now today, you know, professional sports are kind of considered private businesses, and they are, but like you said, they get a lot of tax breaks, they get free land, they get free this, free that, free handouts from the government. And I think they exist in the same way, where a lot of people, you know, can tell you the starting lineup of their favorite baseball team, they can tell you the, you know, the third string quarterback on their favorite football team, but they can't tell you who's their senator or who's their state representative. I mean, it's kind of frightening in that way, but that's what professional sports still does today. It still provides that distraction, I think, which allows a lot of people in government to get away with a lot of things, and that's why they do work together, the professional sports and the federal government.
So it's a bread and circus from what you see.
Exactly. That's the way I look at it, yeah.
You know, I've never really fully considered that. I mean, the thoughts crossed my mind, but I've never sat down and said, gee, how true is this? But, as I think about this, when Obama was president, I read a statistic once that said 50% of Americans didn't know his vice president's name. And I think that goes to validate a lot of what you just said. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at the fantasy football leagues. Listen, I'm a sports guy. And I think fantasy, any sports, is ridiculous. It's a waste of time. I've never, ever looked at it. You know, if a sports talk show comes on, they're talking about fantasy football, next, I'm going to listen to music. And I've never got that level of obsession, but what a distraction. You're absolutely right about that.
Well, just wait. Now that they've, you know, the Supreme Court overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which will basically allow states to legalize betting on sports across the United States. In fact, Delaware today, it was the first state outside of Nevada to offer full betting on any sport you want. The more I think you see gambling get involved at the state level on sporting events, the more all the coverage of sporting events, like you said, with fantasy sports, is going to get even more lopsided toward the gambling end of it. And I think any time you watch a game or a pregame show or a postgame show or you listen to the radio, it's going to be talk about the point spread, it's going to be talk about the betting line, the over-under, how you should bet, who you should bet, who you should not bet, what are the odds. And I think it's going to be good for a certain level of sports fans, but I think for a lot of average sports fans, it's going to turn them off, because I think the way the media covers sports is going to turn the more legalized gambling spreads.
You know, it's funny. I'm glad you brought that up, because that was on my list to talk about. So great minds think alike. And I see this being a transformative Supreme Court ruling where states are going to use this like Indian gaming casinos. And they're going to think, wow, what a great way to make money on this. And we'll just keep the gambling confined over here. But won't that just absolutely increase exponentially the motivation to cheat?
Well, cheat how? You mean within the games?
In other words, you've got Golden State playing the Phoenix Suns. A wide discrepancy in talent. And the point spread of that game is 12 points. But you maybe shave off 4 points to make the game a little closer than it should be and change the betting line so some people can make money. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think that goes on right now. I think no matter if it's legalized or not, I think that's going to continue to happen, because I think the people who have the kind of money who can alter the outcome of games, and there are plenty of people out there, which a lot of people don't believe is true, but it is very true. There are a lot of people betting a lot of money on these games. They're going to still wind up betting in the black market regardless of whether sports gambling is legal or not, because, you know, the legal sports gambling is going to be run by the major corporations that already run it in Las Vegas, like the William Hill and Caesars and those places. And they don't let people walk in and bet like $1 million on a regular NBA game. They just don't, because they don't want that exposure. It's very corporate. And they might think you view as a sharp bettor, so they'll limit your play, and you can't get that kind of money down. Whereas in the illegal market, as it stands today, you can get that money down if you know the right people, and those people aren't going to go away. So that, I think, will still happen on many levels within professional sports today, because, like you say, legal or illegal, there's still going to be those whales out there who want to bet that kind of money and want to influence games and will have an avenue to do so.
Now, I'm going to date myself here, but I played college basketball in the mid to late 70s, and I played briefly with a guy from New York, and he used to talk to me about things like the Rucker tournament, and I mean, most people in basketball have heard of that, and he told me, he said, you can get a betting line on that from your local bookies, and on high school games, he said, there was actually money that changed hands in betting at the high school level in New York City. Have you ever come across betting like that, illegal betting, at that low of level?
Not recently, but again, when I went through those FBI files, they did. The FBI had looked at a couple times at, you know, that potential of fixing games at the high school level because of betting lines. I mean, it's crazy to think of it, but that's the problem with sports. You know, as sports evolve and people push their kids more and more sports, I mean, you see corruption at the Little League level. You know, it's crazy. I mean, they already, even the Little League World Series, you've had, what, like two champions? United States champions, like, lose their championship because a team from Chicago a couple years ago was illegally put together from kids from outside the proper district, and then there was a team from New York that had a 14-year-old pitching as a 12-year-old. I mean, it's just crazy. It's like wherever there's sports, wherever there's money, wherever there's potential for this massive success, you find corruption and cheating. It just, like, goes hand in hand.
So as corrupt as our politics are today, is it safe to say sports is just a microcosm of that?
Oh, I believe wherever there's money, there's corruption. And, you know, professional sports is, what, about a $25 billion a year business, just the major four sports, you know, the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, and the NHL. And $25 billion floating around out there, somebody's going to try to find a way to get a piece of that pie, and they're going to try to exploit it.
Well, let's talk about the NBA lottery for a second here. One thing that struck me, and it's impolite to talk about it because you got to bring up a special needs kid, and I think you know where I'm going with this, Dan Gilbert and the Cleveland Cavaliers, and let's address that because I'm sure that you saw the collusion there as well.
Well, and it became kind of the hip thing in the NBA to have, you know, somebody, didn't they have like their 90-year-old owner's mother or something there for the draft lottery, and they keep bringing up these, like you said, the special needs kid and that sort of thing, and then sure enough, they're the ones who wind up with the number one pick. I mean, like you say, it's show business. It's entertainment. It's they create a story, and then they fulfill that story, whether it's the dynasty team or it's the Cinderella team. I mean, look at the Las Vegas Golden Knights in the NHL. I mean, I think that's a complete make-believe snow job. I don't believe that team's that good. I don't believe they should be playing in the NHL Finals for the Stanley Cup. I think how they got there is the fact that the guy who owns the team spent $500 million to buy the team, and his money basically paid his way to this Stanley Cup Final to get a return on his investment.
Interesting you say that. That also was on my list to bring up, because we're talking about an expansion team here.
Yeah.
That went into Las
Vegas. I mean,
they
didn't exist 2 years ago. They didn't exist whatsoever.
No.
A year ago, they didn't have a roster.
No, and so how are they good enough in that time frame to be in the Stanley Cup Finals, the best two teams in hockey? That doesn't make any sense.
None at all. But people are eating it up. I mean, I was in Las Vegas at the end of April, beginning of May, and that town was crazy for that team, which is great. But at a certain level, you have to think, well, again, this guy paid $500 million to get this team, build the arena, and take his claim in Las Vegas. It's amazing how well that money worked out for him, because, like you said, the town was, you know, Golden Knight mad. The team was doing great. They made the playoffs. And amazing, it all happened in the wake of that old Vegas Strong thing when they had the shooting at the country music festival there.
Yes.
It's like as soon as that happened, unfortunately, the team's picked up on that Vegas Strong iconic thing, and then the team exploded. And it just, I find it kind of coincidental. Again, if you want to talk about distraction, the government, and that sort of thing, it's amazing how those two things got tied together.
Well, I want to talk to you about Pete Rose for a second, too. I was coaching my team. Oh, gosh, the years kind of run together after you've retired for a while. But I think it was about 2004, if I remember correctly. And we were playing in a tournament out in California, Southern California. And Pete Rose's son was in the tournament. And we all recognized him. And I thought, wow, he's there and he's got his entourage and stuff. And I was sitting next to him and I was scouting our next opponent. And we started to talk. And I have to tell you, the guy's engaging. I enjoyed him. I got to know him pretty well over a three-day period. He went and bought baseballs for my entire team and signed all of them. I mean, he came back with his box of baseballs. And he was so gracious to our kids. I really liked him. And here was one of the most celebrated baseball players in all of Major League Baseball history. And he gets run out of the league for betting as a player and as a manager. So talk about Pete Rose in reference to everybody else. Was he just the unlucky one to get caught, or how bad was he?
Well, from what I actually interviewed John Dowd, who's the guy who ran baseball's investigation of Pete Rose when he was a manager, and which I didn't know, but the Major League Baseball actually investigated Pete Rose like in the early 1970s for betting on baseball while he was a player. So they actually had suspicions about this guy for a very long time because he was known to go across the river into Kentucky from Cincinnati and bet horses there. And he was a heavy horse player. He bet a lot of money there, and they believed he was betting on baseball. They just couldn't prove it at the time because what Rose was doing, even as a manager when he got caught, was he was betting through somebody else. He wasn't obviously placing the bets himself. He had what they call a beard, so he had a third-party bet basically for him. And so Major League Baseball didn't catch him back then, and then Major League Baseball went and destroyed all their notes from that investigation. They, like, erased it from the records. So then when the whole thing cropped up in the 80s, when he was the manager and Dowd did his investigation, they had to start fresh, but it basically led to the conclusion we know. And, I mean, I honestly think Rose is rightfully out of the game and shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. I think, you know, baseball had one cardinal rule, don't bet on baseball, and he broke it, and he should be ousted for it.
Was there ever any evidence that supported the fact that he ever betted on his team to lose?
He didn't have to. Because here's what would happen, is if they were playing like a three-game series, like against the Cubs or whoever, you know, in game one, if he thought they were going to win, he would go bet on the Reds. And then he would do as a manager whatever he possibly could do to win that game because he wanted to win his bet. So he'd burn through his bullpen. He would just, you know, do whatever he could in that game. to win his bet. And then, like, game two, he might bet on the Reds again and do the same thing. But then come game three, he basically knew his team was spent, and then he wouldn't bet on his team because he'd already blown through his bullpen. He wore out his two best starters, did whatever he had to do. So game three was basically almost like a fixed game without being fixed because he just destroyed his team in the first two games. So not only was he kind of manipulating games to win his bets, at the same time, he was tipping off his bookie and other bookies associated with that guy, telling him when to bet the Reds and when not to bet the Reds. So he was really doing it on two fronts, and that's why, like I say, to this day, I would say there's no way that guy should be in the Hall of Fame for what he did.
Was he in collusion with organized crime, has been alleged?
That I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, though, that he was, I think one of the guys that ratted Rose out was also a steroid dealer, which is kind of interesting given how baseball turned in the late 1980s and 90s with the steroids thing.
Yes.
And there was Rose talking with a steroid dealer and betting with or through a steroid dealer. So it's kind of interesting, that connection. But I don't know the organized crime thing. I just don't know.
It is very interesting. You know, but I almost see an air of forgiveness towards him now, where if he just kind of keeps his mouth shut and acts like a good citizen, he may one day get back in the Hall of Fame or get to the Hall of Fame. Do you think that's possible?
It is, and it's interesting, which I didn't know until my father and I donated something to the Baseball Hall of Fame. The Baseball Hall of Fame is actually not owned or really affiliated with Major League Baseball. It's a separate entity. They work with Major League Baseball, but they're not owned by Major League Baseball. So really, they can do whatever they want. If the Baseball Hall of Fame wanted him in the Hall of Fame, they could let him in the Hall of Fame. Because even though he's banned from Major League Baseball, it really has nothing to do with the actual Baseball Hall of Fame, which I never knew, like I say, until a few years ago.
I knew a politician from that era. Person was in Congress, and out of deference to his confidence he gave me, I'm not going to disclose the name, but he told me, he said that Pete Rose basically had to shut up or the mafia would have killed him, that he was connected to organized crime, and they worked really hard to cover that up so they didn't impugn the integrity of the game. But he also told me, if you think he's alone, you're crazy.
I'm sure he's not alone. It's funny. I was just going to say, if you ever go to the Gamblers Anonymous website and look up what are the characteristics of a compulsive or addicted gambler, there's like five or six traits, are the exact traits you would want in an athlete. They're like hand in hand. It's like the same thing. So I'm surprised. I mean, it's actually crazy when you think about it, that there's been no athlete, I mean, in any major sport, who's gotten busted for gambling on sports since Pete Rose. I mean, it's really impossible.
You know, statistically, you're right. It's absolutely impossible. I mean, yeah. Addiction rates for gambling are really no different than they are for cocaine or alcohol.
Yeah, and you can find players who have had trouble with all of those, amongst other things. You know, beating women, beating children, carrying guns, what have you. They've broken all kind of laws, but the one law that no athlete's been busted of in 30-some-odd years is gambling on sports, which, again, I find impossible unless the leagues are covering it up to save face.
And when you take a look at sports across the board, the major sports, the four majors, hockey, baseball, basketball, football, which one jumps out at you as the most corrupt, the most compromised?
The NBA, because, again, you can point specifically to, like, the game tanking. You can point to the officiating in a lot of times in the playoffs. And you can see things right on your television that tell you this stuff isn't as legitimate as they're purporting it to be. I mean, like you say, there's always bad calls. You can watch, you know, things on your TV and you can see an official making a mistake. But sometimes there's such egregious errors being made, especially in the age of instant replay, when, you know, you can watch a football game and you can see a guy step out of bounds and the official will go to the review, then he'll come back onto the field and then he'll say, guy never stepped out of bounds. And you're like, well, I could see it right on my TV. How's this guy not seeing it? When you see stuff like that, you realize this isn't exactly what they're telling me it's going to be. But like you say, to me, it's the NBA is the one that is just the most kind of almost in your face with the problems that are supposedly not problems.
There was, and forgive me for not remembering the exact year, but there was a time, and this is when I really started to walk away from really watching the NBA with any interest, that the Phoenix Suns were going to put San Antonio out of the playoffs. And they went into San Antonio, and they won a road game, which would have tipped the balance. But in the game, Bruce Bowen took Steve Nash and put him into the scorer's table on one of the most flagrant fouls I've ever seen. Two of the Suns players walked onto the floor, didn't even confront Bruce Bowen, but it was more like a shock reaction, an anger reaction. But earlier in the game, when there was an altercation, the star for the San Antonio Spurs, Tim Duncan, in an altercation, walked off the bench and went all the way to the middle of the floor at the free throw line. And the two Suns players, prominent players, got suspended. They ended up losing the series, but nothing happened to Tim Duncan, who did the exact same thing. And I said right then, the fix is in. And I'll tell you, it was a year later, Brian Colangelo, the owner of the Suns, sold the team. I think he had had enough. Are you familiar with that incident?
Yeah, I do remember that to a certain extent. But like I say, you can go to any sport and find similar problems. You know, you can find, like, just, what was it, a few years ago when Des Bryant made this one catch against the Green Bay Packers in the playoffs games, and it was right on the goal line. It was like a fourth and one play, and they ruled it an incomplete pass. And, you know, they're able to do so because they cited rule A, B, and C, whereas they could have called it a catch citing X, Y, and Z if they wanted to. It could have gone either way, but they decided to rule against the Cowboys on that particular play. Now, 3 years later or whatever it is, the NFL recently came out and said, yeah, you know, that should have been a catch. We screwed that one up. And they've done that, you know, since then on other plays. And the NBA's done it, too, where it's like, yeah, you know, our officials really screwed that up. Oh, well, tough break. Wait a second. You can't just say tough break and move on. You either have to fix your officiating, which you're not going to do, or, you know, people have to recognize what they're watching isn't necessarily what they think it is, and that it's really just entertainment. And you have to take it like a movie and understand that it may be scripted. They may be making Cinderella right in front of you on your TV screen, on the court or on the field, and they're going to make you believe in the fairy tale, even though it's not really what's happening.
Well, I said the same thing after Hurricane Katrina, where the New Orleans Saints had been so bad, their fans used to wear bags over their heads to the games to mock the team. And then here comes Hurricane Katrina, which ravaged the city of New Orleans. And the very next year, this downtrodden team somehow found a way to win the NFL Super Bowl. That was improbable.
Oh, I think one of the most fixed football games of all time was the reopening of the Superdome after Hurricane Katrina. They played, I think it was the Falcons, on like Monday Night Football. And that whole broadcast was a love fest to New Orleans about the hurricane. And there's a famous play where one of the Saints guys ran in and blocked a punt, and they actually immortalized that. Now there's a statue outside of the Superdome immortalizing that one play. And they had, like, the president was there. And, I mean, there was no way that the Atlanta Falcons would have walked out of that stadium victorious that night. There was no way it was going to happen. That game was rigged from top to bottom. And like I say, probably for political purposes, probably for feel-good purposes, for storytelling purposes, but there's no way that was going to end any other way than in a Saints victory. And there's been other games similar to that, but nothing as impactful, I think, as that one right after the hurricane.
Well, I looked at that, and then I shook my head, and I said, this is just total rig job here. There's no way I bought the fact that the best team in the NFL that year was the New Orleans Saints. But it was a feel-good story, just like Dan Gilbert and his special needs kid when they improbably won the number one pick in the NBA lottery. Let's go through some of this.
But I was going to say, though, but, you know, and that's happened since then. I mean, after the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, then we had Boston Strong, and the Bruins went to the Stanley Cup Finals that year, and the Red Sox won the World Series that year. Amazingly, once they became Boston Strong, both teams reached the finals. And then just last year, you had the Houston Astros become Houston Strong in the wake of the hurricane that wrecked Houston last year, and they went on to win the World Series. And again, like I said earlier in their interview, we had Las Vegas become Vegas Strong after the shooting, and here the Golden Knights are in the Stanley Cup Finals. I mean, it's amazing that these big, you know, to-dos happen in a city, and tragedies, really, that happen to a city, and suddenly a team gets attached to that tragedy, and then suddenly that team succeeds. I mean, it's amazing. You can only point to those certain things, and yet every outcome is the same. How is that possible?
Let me put on my anti-conspiracy hat for a second, okay?
Sure.
And so let me ask you a question. All right, what does the league gain by promoting these feel-good stories? How do they benefit? Who benefits?
Well, I think, obviously, you know, the team, the local team benefits because, like in the case of Houston, you have a problem getting people to the stadium after a hurricane, after, you know, the Katrina. A lot of people have problems in New Orleans after that, and you need them to, you know, rally around the football team. I think it becomes a rallying part for the city, like you say, which does good for the politicians there. It does good because then it gets people off the federal government and FEMA's back because they didn't necessarily do the job they should have done in the wake of such tragedies. I mean, I think, and again, it becomes a distraction because no longer are we talking about the hurricane or no longer are we talking about the bomb. I mean, now we're talking about how good the team is doing and how good the city is doing once that's behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, again, it kind of benefits everyone involved, and it also benefits the sports leagues because it becomes a story and it gets people to tune in. And it gets non-fans to watch because they wonder, well, is the Cinderella story going to really happen or not?
Interesting. That's really interesting. Let's take sport by sport. Let's take the three majors, baseball, basketball, football. And what do you see as the most common ways that the fix is in sport by sport? So with basketball, let me give you my layman's opinion with very little statistics to back it up. I think it's the non-call that can change games the easiest. The referee just swallows his whistle, play on. But let's go through the sports. What do you see as being the primary way that they cheat?
Well, I think officiating in all three sports is a big question. Because like you say, the non-call can be as big as the call that's made, especially in football and basketball. Because in football, you know, a team's down, they throw a bomb, and there's obviously contact between the wide receiver and the cornerback, the official standing right there, and it's like, well, if he throws the flag and calls pass interference, it gives this team that's behind an extra 50 yards that they really didn't deserve. Or, like you say, does he swallow his whistle and just play on and tough break for that contact? I mean, so there's a lot of, you know, 50-50 calls out there that either get made or don't get made. In baseball, which a lot of people don't realize, it's balls and strikes.
Yes.
For the umpire. I mean, it really matters, and it can really put pressure on a pitcher and on a team depending how the umpire is calling the balls and strikes. And which even scares me more, actually, in baseball now is the juiced baseballs, which they won't admit is happening. But that's altering the game as well.
Do you mean in terms of the home runs that are hit?
Well, yeah, it's amazing. You can go back just, I think it was 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, Rob Manfred became the commissioner of Major League Baseball. And it's like basically his welcoming press conference. He said, we have to do something about offense in baseball because people are tired of these 1-0 games, 2-1 games. They like home runs. They like that action. You know, we need to do something about that. And since then, since he made that comment, baseballs have been flying out of Major League parks at a record pace. And what it basically is I do believe it's a juiced baseball. And what it is, and what people don't totally understand, because Major League Baseball doesn't make this really known, is there's tolerances within the baseballs. How they're wrapped, how big the core is, how high the stitches are, et cetera, et cetera. And so they can produce a baseball that's really soft, or they can produce a baseball that's really hard, and both fall within the league's quote-unquote tolerances, but one will fly out of the ballpark, and one will not. And so I think they've actually told their baseball makers, this is how we want to make them. It's making balls fly farther than ever before, and it's increasing ratings and it's increasing attention on Major League Baseball because, like you say, there's been more home runs hit now than there was in the steroid era during Sosa, McGuire, and Bonds.
That is interesting development. I'm not as familiar. I've heard the allegation with the ball. I'll tell you what I have noticed is that in Major League Baseball, if the ball even touches the ground, they now throw it out. That never used to happen. And so Does that preserve the integrity of these juice balls? Is that connected somehow?
I don't know. I'm not really sure, but it wouldn't surprise me that the way they're cycling through these things. And who knows? I mean, maybe there's a bag of juiced balls and a bag of regular balls, and they use the juiced balls when they want to. I mean, who's to say? You know, who really pays attention to some of these little things that can have a big impact on the game? I mean, because people went all crazy with Tom Brady and the whole Deflategate thing with the New England Patriots and whether or not, you know, there's a certain PSI in each football. But no one's talking about how well the baseball is constructed, because let me tell you, like I said, and it's factual. Anybody can look it up. More home runs have been hit now than ever before in league history.
You bring up Deflategate. That was actually on my list. I was just going to bring it up next. How do you see that? I almost see it as a bias against the reigning champion, and maybe they're sick of the champion against New England, going after their star quarterback on this with Deflategate. In case people don't know, very quickly, Deflategate was where Tom Brady, the star quarterback of the New England Patriots that wins a lot of championships, was accused of deflating balls to levels that he would like and would help his performance. And it was illegal to do so. And he got off initially, but ultimately the league won and suspended him. Why would the league go after their darling child in Tom Brady and the New England Patriots?
I honestly think, and a lot of people never thought this way, but I honestly think the league went after Brady to show that no player is above the owners in the league itself. And I think it was kind of like a middle finger almost to the players union to say, look, we go after Tom Brady. We'll suspend Tom Brady. We don't care. We're in charge. It's our league. This is how we do things. And I think Deflategate was just kind of almost an afterstory compared to that. And I think, you know, the same thing with the kneeling in the national anthem and how the league's handled that. I think when they get back to the negotiating table for the next collective bargaining agreement, which comes up, I think, in 2020, I think the league's done this stuff on purpose because they're going to get certain concessions out of the players. Because the players are going to go after them for the Deflategate thing, and they're going to go after them for the kneeling at the national anthem thing, and the league will say, okay, we can, you know, we'll concess, you know, we'll allow you to have those things, but this is what we're going to get from you in return, and it's going to force the players to sign another bad deal.
That is really, I hadn't even thought of it that way. That's that's just eye-opening to me. You know, there was a movie made back, oh gosh, mid-70s, was when I was just starting in college, and it was called Rollerball. Are you familiar with that movie?
Yeah. Oh, I remember that. With James Caan.
James Caan, starring as Jonathan E., who was the superstar of Rollerball, and it was kind of the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, all rolled into one, and there was a fanaticism planet-wide in following Rollerball, and they used the game to control people's social and political attitudes. And Jonathan E. was so good, they tried to make him retire early so no one could be bigger than the game. And you're saying the NFL, you think, just did that with Tom Brady on Deflategate. That's an interesting comparison there. That's fascinating that you'd see it that way. That never occurred to me. I had never thought of that.
Well, and like I said, it wouldn't surprise me if that's what it boiled down to, because I can't imagine the PSI of a couple of pounds per square inch on the football really mattered that much to the league or anyone within it. Especially when the fact that the game where it supposedly happened, I mean, I think New England won like 45-7 or something like that. I mean, it wasn't like they lost, you know, the Colts lost a heartbreaker to the Patriots in the game. They got just smeared. I think it had more of a impactful meeting behind the scenes, and that Deflategate thing was just, again, almost like bread and circusing. It was just a major distraction.
Yeah, I feel like we've just touched a surface. We're almost out of time here. This is one of the quickest hours we've ever had. We've had two in a row now here on this particular show. I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell people how to follow your good work. I know you have a website. You've written some books. So let's tell the listening audience, if you want to know more, that it's just not politics that's corrupt that we cover on this show. The sports world is just as bad. How do they follow your good work?
The best place to go is my website, which is thefixisin.net. Not .com, but .net. And there they can find all my books. They can find my Twitter feed, my Facebook stuff, articles I've written just for the website. And hopefully by this time next year, I should have another book out. So the best place to go is the website.
Just a quick question here that occurred to me. You're treading on some sacred ground here with lots of money at stake. And have you ever felt the pressure? Have you ever been threatened? I mean, that's where I'm going with this.
Well, we could do a whole show kind of almost on that. But I've never really been threatened per se. But what I find is that for me to get my work out, to get exposure, that's a completely different story. Because I know that there's been certain times there's a couple, like a television show that I was supposed to make a couple appearances on that they canceled to the last minute. There's some radio networks, especially ESPN, that literally I've been on over 200 some odd radio shows across the country and podcasts. And there's certain radio outlets that will not have me on the air no matter what. And I can't imagine it's just because I think it's because they don't want me broaching these subjects. And they don't want people to know about it.
Yeah, there's a in the world of politics, there's a real anti-First Amendment environment that's emerging right now. We're seeing it in social media, where conservative opinion is ostracized and actually suppressed. And you're kind of confirming that exists in the sports world if you're not on board with the message.
It totally. I can, like you say, I mean, I can prove it to people that it's happened to me on purpose. That it's just not like an accident, that people have literally made sure I don't appear on certain shows or my work doesn't get out there. And like I said, that's what scares me, is the fact that I'm talking about sports, which is really, in the grand scheme of things, no big deal. So who's out there talking about more important stuff, like you say, in the political realm or elsewhere, that can't get their message out because the powers that be don't want them to?
Man, and people are saying, Dave, why are you doing a sports show? You do political shows. Well, I think you just got your answer right there. Thank you very much. This has really been I hate to say fun because it's kind of morbid, but it's been interesting. It's been a lot of fun for me to cover this because you're confirming so much of what I've always wondered. But we got to do this again soon and talk about you and censorship with the media. I'd like to hit that topic as well. But thanks for joining us, Ryan. It's been really informative and entertaining.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, Dave. I appreciate it.
Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back after this message.